Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is one of my absolute favorites. He really needs no introduction. His name is Rick Rule. Rick, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Flattery will get you everywhere, George. Thank you very much for having me back.
All right. So let's dive into commodities. I know we've got a lot to talk about here. It's on everyone's mind. You know, are we going to get inflation, disinflation? What's the Fed going to do? Are they going to raise rates 7 times in 2022? Are they not? Is the market going to crash as a result? If so, what does that do to the price of oil and uranium and coal and tobacco and all the fun stuff we like to talk about?
Well, you lead off with a fairly big question. do we have a week? Let's try and take them sequentially, George, with the caveat that I'm not actually an economist. I'm a credit analyst, or some would say unflatteringly a loan shark. But from a loan shark's perspective, I think there's some probabilities that we could look at in the market. With regards to inflation, are we going to get inflation? 3 years ago, yes, we were going to get inflation. We have it now. Yeah. We aren't seeing a response to it, at least a response amongst investors, because investors haven't had to cope with inflation for 40 years. They see it, they're coming to understand it, but they haven't felt its bite since the decade of the 1970s. This reminds me of nothing so much as 1968, when, as a very young man, I noticed the writing on the wall for inflation, but I was interested in the complacency that people exhibited towards it. That was because for 20 prior years, through the 50s and 60s, we lived through a very benign economic period. And today, paradoxically, the fact that we've lived through 40 years of benign economic circumstance from 1982 to, say, 2020, I think has caused people, although they perceive inflation, not to be afraid of its bite yet.
Rick, what was the CPI in 1968? Do you recall what it was?
I don't recall. I don't recall. I remember that a little later in the mid-1970s, it was in double digits.
You know, the Fed raised rates to try to get ahead of it in the early 70s. I think they actually did it twice before Volcker did, try to take rates positive in real terms.
You're very right. Late 1974 and early 1975, the Fed raised rates 2 or 3 times, killed the stock market. Did nice things for the US dollar. And by the way, killed the gold price. The gold price fell by half in 1975. People who were shaken out by that, of course, missed a move from $100 an ounce to $800 an ounce, or $850 an ounce over 6 short years. But, you know, we all learn lessons from the past. At any rate, yes, the Fed absolutely raised interest rates in the middle part of the 1970s, in 1975 to be exact. And the impact on the economy and the reaction of the political donors and the voters was such that the Fed lost their nerve. And maybe later in this talk, we can talk about why past is prologue with regards to raising interest rates now. But the point you make, I think, is very good. There isn't much of a there's a perception of inflation, but there isn't yet a fear of inflation because people haven't been bitten by it for 40 years. People complain about higher gas prices. People complain about rents. People complain about the price of avocados or something like that. But they haven't really seen the impact of both inflation, which is to say their cost of living escalating very rapidly, at the same time that savers in particular are experiencing negative interest rates.
Asset prices are going down in nominal terms, potentially.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm sorry for cutting you off
there. No, it's fine.
Back to commodities.
Yep.
And how that pertains to the commodity space.
Let's start with a big disclaimer. Anything that I say about commodities must be listened to in the absence of an expectation of a big recession or a big depression. The story in commodities, I think, ex precious metals, the rest of the commodity space, will be less about inflation, although inflation will be an important part of the story, and more about systemic underinvestment by society in natural resources for 30 years.
Right.
What that means, because these are capital intensive businesses, is that we are beginning now to experience shortages, and we will experience continued shortages, at least on the supply side. If a recession comes along and takes away demand, then you won't see the price increases. But assuming that the economy on a global basis limps along the way it's limping along now, I think higher commodities prices across the board, at least higher nominal commodity prices, are something that we need to get used to. Remember, George, it wasn't inflation that took the oil quote from zero or $20 a barrel to $95 a barrel. It was precisely very low oil prices that led to very high oil prices. During a period of low oil prices, there was no sense conserving because the stuff was so cheap, and there was no sense doing project investments or even sustaining capital investments. Why, if you're losing $20 a barrel, would you try to increase production? And the consequence of low prices was, in fact, high prices, because sustaining capital investments weren't made, and our ability to produce oil very, very, very quickly deteriorated. I use that not to tell people that they ought to be in the oil business, but rather to tell people that in commodities, the cure for low prices is always low prices, and the cure for high prices is always high prices. Markets, in fact, work. And we have been for 30 years and continue to be today under investing substantially in the productive capacity around natural resources, even including oil and gas.
Rick, can governments impede that equilibrium mechanism, meaning the cure for high prices is high prices? What I think about when you say that is ESG. The reason high prices cure high prices because it brings more investment, therefore more supply. But if there's no investment coming in, does that offer a curveball?
Sorry, George, I misinterpreted your word impede. I mean, I believe government impedes everything. At least everything good. And so certainly government action can impede recovery. A circumstance where government, even just jawbones, the one thing that they're very good at, can impede investment. As an example, in the oil and gas business, government, at least Western governments, constant inveiling against the oil industry has meant that the oil industry faces a higher cost of capital in a capital-intensive business. That is impeding. The government is making it more difficult, ironically, for companies to get environmental remediation bonding and that kind of insurance, something that they ought to be, I would have suspected, in favor of. So yes, government can substantially interrupt the positive aspects of a free market. Your ESG question is very interesting. You know, I guess you need to unpack E and S and G. And I suspect that we'll learn 10 years from now that G, governance, is about balancing conflicting demands between E and S. As an example, if you were trying to look at the S part of E, S, and G, is it a social good to provide reasonably priced electricity for 1.2 billion people on Earth that don't have any access to electricity at all? Is it a social good? In other words, is it consistent with S principles? That 2 billion people around the world who experience energy poverty, either intermittent energy or electricity that they can't afford, have access to good energy. Is the fact that humankind over the last 30 years has lifted more human beings out of extreme poverty, both in absolute numbers and as a percentage of the total, is that a social good? Further on the S side, is the progress that the bottom third of humanity has made in the last 30 years, from barefoot to shoes to a bicycle to a 50cc motorcycle to a Toyota Hilux, from mud and wattle housing to cinder blocks, from a thatch roof to a metal roof, from starvation to food security. Was all that a good thing? I think the big thinkers need to think through the way that they accommodate the bottom third of humankind, and they need to incorporate that into the S part of ESG. Remember, George, that most of mankind aspires to live the way that you and I live. And over the last 30 years, we've done a wonderful job of bringing literally billions of people up. The big thinkers need to decide whether that's a good thing, and where the and whether or not the bottom third of humanity has a say in ESG. I would suggest that the answer is yes, of course, that they should have a say. And I would think, too, that that question is apropos to our discussion, because part of the discussion of commodities has to do with the fact that when you raise the material living standards of the bottom third or even the bottom half of mankind, the expenditures that they make, the utility that they drive, is commodities intensive. George, when you get more money, you might buy some fancy service, or you might go out to overpriced dinner and drink an overpriced bottle of wine, or you might buy some little tiny gizmo from Apple. But when a poor person gets more money, they raise their family's median calorie count from 1,200 to 1,800. They put a metal roof on their house. Maybe they get electricity. The point is that when the bottom third or half of humanity becomes richer, which mercifully they're doing, it has an outsized impact on commodities, because commodities is what drives a material standard of living.
Do you know Art Berman?
I do not.
Oh, boy, you'd love to have a conversation with Art, but he's a geologist, and he's very well known on FinTwit and the oil space. And he, whenever I talk to him, he always reminds me, he says, George, energy is the economy. And, you know, if you really think that through, I think it's very profound.
But very useful to the resources dialogue, obviously.
Yeah. You know, Rick, one thing that I kind of struggle with personally is I just try to keep it as simple as possible for my own portfolio. And that's one of the reasons why I like commodities, because outside of the producers, it's pretty easy to tell when the commodity is quote unquote cheap or expensive. Historically speaking, you just adjust for inflation. And oil is the example I use there. I've pulled up a chart of oil going back, as far as I can, 100 years or so. And if you adjust for inflation, you see that when it gets under 30 a barrel, it seems to be pretty cheap, because it kind of reverts to a mean. And then when it gets over maybe 80, 85, it starts to get expensive. So, back in March of 2020, oil was maybe, $20 or something. And I thought it was going down further, but I wanted to buy. And I did buy a lot of the producers, not because I thought the price was going higher, but at the time it was cheap. And so now we're kind of on the flip side of that coin, where oil is at $90 a barrel. And I've tried to kind of scale out of my position just by selling calls. I'm not that sophisticated, but I've got my research assistant helps me out with that. A 19-year-old kid that's far more sophisticated than I am. but that we haven't hit the strike price or so on. But my point is, I believe that oil prices will most likely go much higher in the future. But if I look at my own rules that I've set up for my portfolio, it's expensive. Therefore, I should consider selling. How do you think through that process?
Wonderful question. And the answer is in the middle somehow. First of all, your methodology, simple, is always better. And if you're patient, you can afford to be simple. It's those people who care about a move between now and the next long weekend that have to be complex. For people who have a 5 or 6 year time frame, life can be simple. I use a metric that's very similar to yours. I look at what the International Energy Agency says is the total cost of producing a barrel of oil. That's not just the lifting cost, but rather it includes the exploration costs, G&A, prior year write-downs, which can be huge in the exploration business, social rents, and cost of capital. And the International Energy Agency suggests that worldwide, the fully loaded cost to produce a barrel of oil is between 55 and 60 US dollars.
Okay.
So when the price of oil is substantially below that, the industry's in liquidation. It's a capital-intensive business. There's rapid decline rates. And to the extent that you aren't making sustaining capital and new project investments, you are, within a 2 or 3 year time frame, greatly crimping supplies. Similarly, when the price goes up to a substantial premium to that, people do, in fact, begin to conserve. Markets work, and companies are able and willing to make sustaining capital investments. We're in the odd position now where the oil price is superb from a producer's point of view, but they haven't picked up the pace of capital investments, sustaining capital investments, or new project investments. I think that might be because of Trudeau and Biden and Merkel. I think it might be because the big thinkers of the world are so busy inveighing against energy that investors in energy are asking the companies to return capital to owners as opposed to making sustaining capital investments. If that's the case, higher prices will be with us for longer. The other thing, George, that we should talk about is you told me in a prior interview that for your own portfolio, you want to have 80% of your money in things that pay you.
Right.
The beauty about the natural resource business, if you don't chase incredible alpha by taking the risks and the penny dreadfuls, is that these businesses have a reasonably good history over time of generating free cash and sharing it with shareholders. If you were to construct a portfolio today of 10 or 15 large natural resource companies that were paying dividends in excess of 5% from 40% or less of their free cash flow after sustaining capital investments, it would be an easy portfolio to construct. From that portfolio parameter, it makes sense for you too.
Well, let's take it a step further here. So we understand cheap and expensive. We understand that there's some nuance with the oil market as an example right now that might not make the price cheap. It's so expensive, but there's a very strong argument for it to go higher. So if you were a type of investment or investor that had maybe a different framework than I do, then it still could be a good time to buy. How do we layer on the dividends on top of the buy cheap, sell expensive? I mean, let's just say that something is moderately expensive, but they're just paying an incredible dividend and it's extremely strong. And, you know, I look at that from a standpoint of actually buying the entire business, like a McDonald's, in the sense that, okay, even if it is a little expensive, maybe I should buy it because I never want to sell this, assuming that I continue to get paid what they're paying me right now and definitely into the future.
So when you look at the dividend, you have to look at a sustainable dividend. It needs to be paid out of net free cash flow, that is net of sustaining capital investments. If a company is generating $1 a share in operating margin, and they're paying out 80 cents a share in dividend, that's not sustainable because they're not making sustaining capital investments. They're in fact cannibalizing the company. But if the company is paying a decent dividend out of 25% of free cash flow, and historically they've been able to replace the reserves that they've produced with say 40% of free cash flow, that's a very sustainable business. If you look at the oil business now, in North America, at least, we believe that on a net present value basis, that the companies are discounting $55 or $60 oil. And importantly, they're discounting $3 natural gas prices, prices that are 35% below the peaks, or below the prices that we're seeing today. So even though the oil price has to go down, or doesn't have to go down, but even though the oil price can go down, because it's more than ample to sustain the industry, the truth is that the equities are still priced to discount much, much, much lower oil prices. So we're in an interesting circumstance. The thing that makes me a little more bullish about oil than I normally would be is simply inflation. That is to say that the costs to maintain a company's production, new project expenditures, as an example, sustaining capital investments, as an example, means that the fully loaded cost to produce a barrel of oil might be $60 today, but my suspicion is that 3 years from now, it'll be $70 or $75 a day. In addition, we're experiencing an increase in social rents worldwide around the resource businesses. There will be more permitting delays. There will be more indirect expenses. Oil companies and mining companies will have to build more schools. They'll have to build more infrastructure. And the consequence of that is that in-place assets, paid-for assets, are going to become more valuable simply because constructing competing assets will become more expensive. And because of that, I believe there's maybe more upside to large producing companies in both mining and in oil and gas than people perceive, because the sunk value of their capital, particularly after depreciation and depletion, I think substantially understates the value of those producing assets.
Rick, another thing that I like to try to incorporate into my investing framework and strategy is not only buy cheap, sell expensive, but buy panic and sell hysteria. And I got that from our good friend Jim Rogers.
Right.
And so on that note, I was trying to think this through last night. Okay, we go back to oil. We look at, okay, there's probably a lot more tailwind than there is headwind, even though the price itself, historically speaking, is rather high. If you look at a company that's paying a good dividend and that dividend is very solid, another benefit there or pro would be that in the future, most likely the cost of getting that oil out of the ground will be more expensive. Therefore, it kind of limits your downside, especially if you're wanting to hold that company over the long term. Is there an argument for looking at a company that's tied to Russia? And what I'm referring to specifically is Lukoil. And because, okay, let's just say that oil is trading at 90, a little expensive, but if you can buy Lukoil at a discount, maybe, I know it's probably not this extreme, but let's just say that you could buy Lukoil at where it was trading when oil was $40 a barrel, just because of what's happening with the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. Is that something that in the past you've taken advantage of?
You've put your finger on precisely what I'm doing in my own portfolio. Are there political risks in Russia? Sure. There are political risks in the United States too, and they're understated. I own Gazprom. I own Lukoil. I own Norilsk. I own Polymetal. I own Polyrus. The Russian natural resource companies are, by any reasonable valuation measure, the cheapest on the planet. They have a preponderance of tier one assets, which means not marginal assets, but very, very, very good assets. They have low sustaining capital costs relative to other parts of the world. They have long reserve life indexes relative to other parts of the world. They have high operating margins and high return on capital. And importantly, they're controlled by the oligarchs, which means they have owners. Which means they tend to be shareholder friendly. You know, you look at a company like Polyrus paying out 40% of free cash flow after sustaining capital investments, fairly heavy sustaining capital investments. What you have is that Polyrus is owned by a couple of people. It's not owned by BlackRock and Vanguard and Fidelity. It's owned by living, breathing human beings who believe that the company's obligations to shareholders is larger than their obligation to the World Economic Forum.
That's right. There you go.
Something that I like.
That's a great point right there, because I've talked about that extensively with Chris McIntosh, who's a fantastic global macro investor, someone who's neck deep in the commodity space. And that's one thing that he's looked into moving forward is which countries are going to most likely push back against maybe a World Economic Forum and a Great Reset agenda, therefore might have more inflows of capital for people who believe in free market capitalism. And he has pinpointed Russia as potentially one of those countries, along with the UAE and maybe Brazil. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, what I found and this will make me extremely unpopular with your listeners, but I found that political risk is a matter of perception.
Yeah.
And people who look like you and I often believe that money that's stolen from us by white people in English through the legislature, according to the rule of law, is somehow less gone than money that's taken from us by more traditional methods. I experienced my worst personal experience with political risk in the People's Republic of California, where we made a gold discovery, unfortunately, 7 miles on the wrong side of the California-Nevada line. It took us 13 years to obtain permits for a deposit that was easily permittable under current legislation. And by the way, it cost us $16 million in bribes. Not efficient bribes like you would pay in Congo, but rather campaign contributions, deeds in lieu, things like that. So think about cash flow denied for 13 years, particularly at a time when the U.S. 10-year treasury was at 6 or 7%. And people tell me that California isn't risky. More recently, I owned and have for years a condominium in Vancouver, British Columbia, as a consequence of, you know, a lot of investments in Canada. The voters of Vancouver and British Columbia, in their wisdom, I guess decided that I was deleterious to their economy because I was a foreigner and I didn't live there full time. They decided to tax me 5% of the assessed value of my home in Vancouver on top of the existing 60 basis point property taxes that they all paid. 5% of the assessed value of my home annually.
An unrealized capital gain.
Yeah. And I'm supposed to believe I'm supposed to believe that Canada isn't politically risky. I have invested and been, I'm not trying to say I haven't had trouble, but I've invested years ago in Syria, Sudan, Congo, Niger, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Myanmar. And I'm not trying to say that they weren't exciting times. But you need to understand the nature of political risk. And you need to understand, too, that politics can change. I invested in Congo in 1995 and was rewarded with the beginnings of an immediate civil war where 2 million people were killed. It was a scary time to be invested in the Congo. Mercifully, the copper in the Congo that we were investing in was put in place about 45 million years ago. And the copper was singularly unconcerned about a two-year civil war. It turns out that the inert copper was substantially smarter than the people who lived on top of it. And when they got done murdering each other, enslaving each other, gang raping each other, and civility in some measure returned, the copper was still there. I'm not suggesting that people take a cynical attitude towards political risk. I'm just suggesting that when people look at political risk, they take it in context, they juxtapose it against reward, and they think about the risks that they're facing where they are. My own belief, George, and your viewers will hate me for this, is that the most dangerous government is the one that's the closest to you.
Yeah, boy, that's very profound words. Talking about risk, Rick, I want to think about China, Evergrande. We all know the story there, that real estate, potentially 30% of their GDP. And if that collapses, that's going to be a potential collapse in the demand for a lot of commodities. I think most specific would be iron ore. And I remember, and I haven't looked at it in a few months, but I remember Rio Tinto, they were paying a very good dividend, and their share price really got smacked around because of the Evergrande story, because I think maybe 40% of the revenues are iron ore. So what do you think about iron ore and the China story, and maybe not Rio Tinto specifically, but more in general, what's going on there with that commodity, or maybe commodities more broadly speaking, if we have a crash in China?
I've been amazed by the strength of the iron price worldwide. If you have been in the iron business for as many years as I have, this seems like a long-going fiction, but it is a long-going fiction. The urbanization of emerging and frontier markets, particularly including China, of course, is the story. behind iron. When you say Evergrande, Evergrande as a standalone incident isn't serious. There's about $300 billion in debt. And remember that some of the debt will be good. The shareholders likely go to shareholder heaven. And the pain associated with the creditors will not be evenly distributed. It'll be politically distributed, which means that people who are friends of the regime will do okay, and other people will do less well. But a $300 billion problem in a country with $4 trillion in foreign reserves, with the trade surpluses and the fiscal surpluses that China delivers, I hate to be off color, but it's sort of a pimple on an elephant's behind. The larger problem, however, is the opacity and the over-leveraged nature of the real estate and development business in China. If you look at Evergrande as a symptom rather than an issue, then you need to begin to become concerned. China, I would suggest, has benefited from 40 years of fairly efficient government. Going back to Deng Xiaoping saying to be rich is glorious, abandoning the madness of Mao, and beginning to trust the industriousness and tenacity of the Chinese people, that continues. Mr. Xi trusts his people less, which is to say he's tightening down, clamping down on their freedom, which almost certainly will have negative impacts on the Chinese economy. If you look a little longer term, and this may sound racist, but if you look at the success of the Chinese diaspora around the world, what you see is that you get a lot of economic bang for the buck if you allow them a little more freedom. And I don't think that there is anything in China that isn't correctable with a couple degrees more freedom. Whether or not Mr. Xi has the courage to do that is a different circumstance. It would seem that the Chinese leadership believes that 10,000 people should make all of the effective decisions for 1.4 billion people, and that doesn't reconcile itself too well with freedom. But, you know, I've been investing in China for a very long time, and I have contacts there who are friends. And it has been pointed out to me that China still has 250 million people that they need to urbanize. So when people say, is the China story over? Not as long as there's 1.4 billion industrious, educated, aspirational people. It's like saying, is the American story over? No, there's some speed bumps out there, but the best is ahead.
Yeah, I think that's such a great perspective. And let's move focus. Let's get back to some of the panic stuff. We're talking about panic with Russia.
Yeah.
Have you been taking a look at Turkey?
Yeah, I mean, I love Turkey. I absolutely love Turkey. It is a difficult place to invest in the mining space because the best Turkish mining companies are private. We know Çeluk reasonably well, and they're absolutely first-class people. And I've been wanting to invest in their business for years. And they smile and say, thank you, but no thanks. and I don't know, you know, George, I've learned in 45 years as an investor that I know a lot about and am very good at investing in natural resources. And I know a lot about and I'm very good at investing in conventional financial services. Early in my career, I mistook my success in natural resources for genius or the ability to analyze many different industries. And I learned some painful lessons. I learned that I am no genius, that I'm, in fact, more experienced at certain things than other people are. So when I looked at the length and breadth of the Turkish economy, which is to say businesses in Turkey that I have no real familiarity with, I'm afraid to buy them. You know, similarly in Russia, when Russia really got hammered 5 years ago, I couldn't resist myself and I bought some Sberbank, which is the largest and most diversified bank in Russia and allegedly the one with the best ties to the Kremlin. When I made money on Sberbank, I quickly sold it because they were involved in so many businesses and they were so opaque that not because it wasn't a good bank, but because I couldn't understand it well enough to own it, I had to sell it. I look for investments where I believe I have a knowledge advantage and I have contact advantages. So when you ask me the question about Turkey, I can't answer the question from a country, from the point of view of the country as a whole, except for the fact that I love the place. They have a well-educated young workforce. They are some of the most hospitable people on the planet. They are going through deciding what kind of future they want. And they have a very, very, very strong-willed leader who has made some insane economic decisions. But, you know, it's not as though we haven't had our own idiots from time to time, and somehow we struggled through.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's just, and the reason for the viewers who might not be following the Turkey story, because they're going through not a hyperinflation yet, but what could be considered severe inflation, and it could be an opportunity for crisis investing.
Yep, agreed.
Now or agreed. Maybe in the near future.
And if they have a little bit more political turmoil, Turkey is one of the finest places in the world to travel to visit. So for a tourism opportunity, taking a gullet on the Turquoise Coast, when all of your fellow citizens are afraid of non-existent Muslim extremists in Turkey, is one of the single best uses of your tourism dollars that you can do. It's just absolutely stunning. The food is superb. The scenery is unbelievable. The hospitality is over the top. The biggest risk that you run is that locals will feed you so many dates and so much tea and so much fine food that you'll expire from diabetes or something.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting there too, on a side note, is they've got a program where if you invest 250 grand in real estate, you can get a citizenship or a passport in 3 years. So that's something.
Right.
That's something I'm personally considering. Let's move over to ag. I got that question last night on one of my live streams, and I said, you know what, you got to listen to my interview tomorrow with Rick Rule, because he knows so much more about that space than I do.
Well, you'll recall the first time you interviewed me about 3 years ago, I did everything but call your folks realtor for them in terms of the ag space in the upper Midwest. Unfortunately, I was right a little too quick. Soft commodity prices are up, certain circumstances, 100%. Farm gate incomes are up. And the auctions where we or the managers that we hire to run money for us buy high quality farmland farmland prices now, at least in the upper Midwest, which is what I prefer, are at levels that I can't justify. I can't do it. If farm gate prices fall, or if you are competent at buying land in the Mississippi Delta, you know, Western Tennessee, Eastern Arkansas, Louisiana, in particular, Northwestern Mississippi, that's still pretty cheap. I don't know a passive manager in that region who could buy and operate farmland for me. And George, I'm well past stretch and fence. It's not something I'm going to do for myself.
Right.
You know, agriculture was a great story when you and I first started talking about it. Unfortunately, that was one of those things where we were right 2 or 3 years before I thought we would be right. And the prices, I don't have the courage to buy them. I suspect if I was 29 as opposed to 69, and I was buying for a 40-year future as opposed to a 10 or 15-year future, that I would look at things differently. But agriculture has given me so much so quick that I'm sort of standing back. Now, I haven't sold yet, but I don't have the courage to buy here.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow rebel capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
Yeah, it's kind of like the same thing with me and oil right now.
Yeah.
Let's move over to uranium. I'd love to get your overall view. We talked about this on a panel discussion with Mark Moss the other day that we were involved with, which was great. But if you could give us kind of your broad view of what's happening with uranium. I know I think you said on our panel that it might be a good opportunity because we've had such a big pullback here. And then after that, if you could help us just give us kind of an elementary view of what happened with the Sprott Trust buying up a lot of physical uranium. Because I think people have heard about that, but they might not understand how that actually worked.
With the caveat that I'm retired, I no longer speak for Sprott.
I'm
a director and a large shareholder, but I'm not a spokesperson for Sprott. And some of the things I say embarrass them. so let's go back to uranium. I've had a love affair with uranium that goes back a very long time. It's deeply cyclical. So for a contrarian, the fact that it's cyclical is great. But for a contrarian, what's even better is that most people either don't know about it or hate it. I remember advocating uranium equity speculation in the year 2000. And I knew it was going to be a difficult sell because the sector hadn't performed since 1982, since Three Mile Island. And a sector that hasn't performed for 18 years doesn't get shown a lot of love. What surprised me was the amount of vitriol that I encountered from the dais. People sort of shouted out that I was advocating speculating on Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl. And I was thinking as a contrarian, boy, it doesn't get better than this. Not only are they bored, they hate me. Which meant that I had very, very, very little competition. I remember thinking, apropos comments earlier in this interview, in those days, the uranium price was at $8 a pound, and the International Energy Agency suggested that the fully loaded cost to produce a pound of uranium was $30. So the industry, in arithmetic terms, was losing $22 a pound and doing it 70 or 80 million times a year. It was extremely boring. It was worse than boring. So it was very clear to me that if the uranium price didn't go up, that there wouldn't be any uranium. And what would the impact of that be? Well, very simply, the impact would be that the lights went out because irregardless of the fact that people were offended by Hiroshima and Nagasaki, people, when they enter a room and flip the switch, want the lights to come on. At that point in time, uranium provided 19% of the total electricity demand in the United States and about 25% of the baseload demand. So it was a pretty simple equation. Either the uranium price would go up or the lights would go out. And that ensuing uranium bull market was the single most exciting financial event of my career. At the beginning of that market, uranium was at $8 and there were five junior uranium companies worldwide that had survived an 18-year bear market. By 6-7 years later, the price of uranium had risen to 140 and five companies had turned into 500 companies. The worst performing of the five juniors at the beginning of the cycle went up 22-1.
You know when to sell, Rick?
Well, I will admit I sold too early.
Walk us through your mindset, because I think maybe even tougher to know when to sell.
If the uranium price has to go to 30, I was thinking it'll likely overshoot because even as prices go up, because the business is capital intensive and cyclical, the industry won't be able to create supply fast enough to meet demand. So if the uranium price hits 55 or 60, I got to start to sell. And I did, which means that the move from 80 to 140 took place without me.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely without me. And it felt a little dumb at the time, but you'll remember that a couple of things happened. That era of very high prices brought in a brand new producer, Kazakhstan. And that brand new producer became the world's lowest cost, high volume producer in a fairly short period of time. And on top of that, of course, we had Fukushima, which took out demand from the second largest nuclear consumer in the world. So then the price fell from 145 all the way down to what, $12 or $14, and set the stage for the recovery that we're seeing now. You'll recall again, the first time or second time that you and I talked, the uranium equation was the same as it had been in the year 2000.
Right.
The industry was making the stuff at that point in time for 15 or 16 bucks. Oh, well, pardon me, selling it for 15 or 16 bucks a pound. But now the International Energy Agency suggested that the fully loaded cost to produce a pound of uranium was up around 50. and still, uranium was essential for our economy. The price had to go up, and the price could go up, so the price has gone up.
Do you know the percentage of electricity that in the United States that depends on uranium now? You said it was 19% before 2000.
As I understand it now, uranium as a percentage of total electricity consumption in the United States is between 12 and 13%. Okay. And baseload production has fallen now to 18 or 19%.
Okay.
But that doesn't matter. It's still a circumstance where if the price doesn't go up, the lights go out. So right now we have a circumstance where it costs about $60 a pound to make the stuff fully loaded, and it sells for 45, meaning the industry is only losing $15 a pound and trying to make it up on volume. what's important to look at now, I knew that arithmetically the price had to recover, but I also knew that as a consequence of Fukushima, that there were large amounts of physical inventory around. And the people who consumed uranium didn't have to do so in contract pricing, but could do it in spot pricing because of excess inventories. And I said at the time that you and I interviewed that I didn't know when we would chew through those inventories. But when that happened, that I thought the price of uranium would begin to rebound. Beginning 3.5 years ago, I tried very hard to interest Sprott Inc. in getting control of Uranium Participation Corp. and converting it to a trust. And they tried mightily for 2.5 years and finally succeeded last year. And when I say succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. I thought because the volume in our precious metals trusts on the New York Stock Exchange exceeds our volume on the Canadian exchanges, 9-to-1, I had thought that we would need to domesticate the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust under the New York Stock Exchange before we would see sufficient volumes to finance in the at the market financing mechanism and buy uranium. And I was way wrong. That trust has, in 4.5 months of existence, raised 1.2 billion fresh US dollars, used it to buy 20 something million pounds of uranium. And I'm tempted to say that most of the surplus inventory available on the spot market has now been or will shortly be bought. At the same time, and more importantly, long term, the political winds are finally blowing in favor of uranium as cheap baseload carbon-free air. The Japanese nuclear fleet, which was somewhere between 40 and 50 reactors, I forget the exact number, frankly, has seen 11 restarts. But importantly, the Japanese government has their 18 largest remaining reactors in for permitting for restarting this year, which means that beginning this year, fresh demand for 10 or 12 million pounds a year is coming into the market on top of a market that is already consuming more uranium because of Chinese builds than pre-Fukushima. So we have a circumstance where the timing question has been answered. Now, you'll recall too, George, that 6 or 7 months ago, the price of uranium equities got so hot, anticipating these trends, I guess, that at least with regards to my juniors, I was forced to be a seller. Although I was long-term optimistic, I just wasn't willing to pay the price. Mercifully for me, now that the timing question has been answered, and now that the pace of Japanese restarts, which I myself identified as the catalyst, is beginning to occur, the index of uranium equities is off, depending on the index you use, between 40 and 50%. So now that it's timely, and now that the catalyst is in place, it's at a 50% off sale. These types of serendipitous good fortune have occurred to me sort of once every 10 years in my life, and I'm delighted that in retirement they're occurring again. The consequence of that, George, as you so generously mentioned, is that I'm putting on a uranium investors boot camp March 19th. I think you said that you would be able to put the links to that. In this interview, it'll be an 8-hour long affair, so it'll be grueling, but you don't have to listen to it all at once. It'll be available as a recording. And we're going all out. We're going to talk about the global politics of uranium from a former energy secretary. We're going to talk about the Chinese view of uranium from China General Nuclear, a Chinese peristatal company. We're going to talk about global supply and demand by Kazatomprom, the Kazakh company that produces 40% of global supply. Yeah. We'll talk about the North American market structure with Cameco, the largest market cap uranium company in the world. We'll have analysts with 30 years experience, you know, not pundits who emerged in the last 2 years who couldn't spell uranium in 2020. The price of all this is $99 with a full money back guarantee. Any of your listeners who come to the, they have to show up. I mean, they actually have to listen to the workshop. But any of them who listen to the workshop and believe they didn't get their $99 worth, email me. I'll give them a full cash refund. So the financial risk is mine. And it's just amazing that we're able to do this at a point in time where all of the catalysts are in place to take the industry higher, while coincidentally, the cover charge, if you will, the price of admission has fallen by half.
Yeah, exactly. What's the date on that, Rick?
March 19th.
March 19th. Okay. And it's
okay. It's not timeless information, but it won't be stale on March 21st. If March 19th is inconvenient for you, it's okay. Come to the seminar, watch it 2 days late. It'll all still be good.
We talked about uranium. I want to conclude by going over coal and any other commodities that you're really excited about. And then maybe tobacco as well, just because I always like tobacco because what it's done since the 1990s, and it's just something everyone hates.
Boy, you're just you're trying to get me in all kinds of trouble. I love it. You know, I'm sure if people hadn't been set up for this and we assembled a group of your listeners in a room and asked them what the fourth best performing commodity was in 2021, nobody would get coal.
Yeah.
But thermal coal, the price doubled. If you would ask people,
the dividends were ridiculous.
If you ask people what the highest demand year for coal was in recorded history, it was 2021. Greta and Angela Merkel notwithstanding. Actually, Angela Merkel helped. But when she shut down the nuclear fleet, the Germans had no choice in order to stay warm but to burn coal. So I misspoke. Angela Merkel, despite her best efforts to the contrary, was a great friend of coal. Now, in truth, the coal stocks are beginning to get a lot of love. And coal is difficult to invest in. When I invest in commodities, I'm not looking solely for leverage to commodity price. I want companies that are in the best quartile worldwide in terms of operating cost and in the best quartile worldwide in terms of return on capital employed. And unfortunately, in the coal business, the best companies in the world are multi-commodity miners, meaning that while they're important to coal, coal is less important to them. There are very few coal pure plays that I can buy within my investment criteria. The people whose investment criterion are less strict than I can probably be very generous in the coal space, the Peabodys, you know, the Colonials. For me, I sort of get stuck in the BHPs, the Glencores, the Rio Tintos, because those companies are the lowest cost and best capital allocators. It's interesting to note that the multi-commodity producer Glencore was recently able to buy a partner out of a very large, very profitable coal mine with about 30 years reserves left. And they bought it for 1.5 times cash flow. Think about buying a 30-year income stream for 1.5 times cash flow. Let's assume that peak coal demand, let's assume as an example that Germany figures out a way to make electricity from solar in a place where the sun doesn't shine. Let's give them that just for fun. It isn't going to occur for a very long time. Meanwhile, around the world, the poorest of the poor, including the Chinese, are building coal-fired power plants like mad. I guess they're untroubled by the fact that the big thinkers of the world flew 520 private jets to Davos to tell you and I to drive less. I think you're making a very, very good point. Let me rephrase it. I am one who believes that we need to pump less crap into the air and we need to pump less crap into the ocean. We need to do that. We need more solar power. My joke's notwithstanding. We need more wind power. We need more oil and gas. We need more geothermal. We need more nuclear. We need to continue to lift up the poorest of the poor worldwide and give those people the opportunity to excel and to live like we do. And the consequence of that is that we will be burning both metallurgical and thermal coal for 30 years, whether the big thinkers like it or not.
Exactly. Exactly. So that makes a lot of sense with coal. What about, I also want to get to the gold miners. I know we're probably running short on time, but what about tobacco and then the gold miners quickly?
I've got to absent myself from the tobacco discussion because it's really a branded goods marketing discussion.
Okay.
And I have, you know, George, I didn't know how to dress myself. So understanding the impact of a narrative on popular culture is not something I can do. Certainly, when I look at the returns on capital employed by Altria and the free cash flow on a unit of production basis, it's one of the best businesses that ever existed. I mean, you know, you kind of make the stuff for 25 cents a pack, sell it for, I don't know, $8 a pack. You pay your 40% ransom to the government and you have no sustaining or capital requirements.
Rick, have you looked at cannabis?
You know, I'm going to start looking at cannabis now, but again, you have a branded goods marketing business.
Okay.
I have to admit to you, George, I'm 69. I haven't done really good due diligence on cannabis for about 45 years. I don't have any durable competitive advantage.
At least haven't inhaled in 45 years, right?
I don't look at it as a farming business or anything like that. I look at it as a branded goods marketing business. I do note that now in the California market, that there are several public companies that are selling at discounts of net cash. Now, in fairness, they're not profitable yet, but a business selling at a discount to cash in the treasury is a business that starts to get my interest. That's a margin of safety that I can understand. But I need to say that, handicapped by my own lack of knowledge, I haven't participated in the industry yet. I certainly like the idea. It would appear in both California and British Columbia, the two jurisdictions that I like pillorying the most, that the state can't even profit from an ostensible monopoly. It would seem that they've piled so many regulations and taxes on the legal part of the marijuana industry that the traditional part of the marijuana industry outcompetes them consistently on quality, price, and, as I understand it, home delivery. I think that's wonderful personally.
Okay, so let's move on to the gold miners.
After, for timeliness, the uranium miners, I just think it's a wonderful sector. I really believe, George, for reasons that we've recited, that the wind is in gold sails, and we should recite them. Quantitative easing. We talked about this before. If you did it, if you printed up gammons, you'd be counterfeited. They'd throw in a slammer. But if you were a senator, it would be policy and you'd be highly popular. Quantitative easing, the fact that 35%, I think it is, of all US dollars in circulation have come into circulation in the last 30 months, should make somebody nervous about the efficacy of the purchasing power of other types of savings and investment assets denominated in US dollars. They're making specious ones by the billions. Oh, pardon me, by the trillions. So that's the first thing. Remember that gold has moved traditionally when investors are concerned about the purchasing power of other savings and investment assets denominated primarily in the world's reserve currency, the US dollar. So quantitative easing would certainly be one. More pernicious is debt and deficits. We passed through $30 trillion in on-balance sheet liabilities on the federal balance sheet Nate, pardon me, $22 trillion, pardon me, net of the growth in the Federal Reserve through, of course, counterfeiting. But more concerning, George, is $120 trillion in net present value of federal obligations for things like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. We have $150 trillion in obligations that we propose to pay for out of a budget of $3 trillion a year in deficit. Interesting math. That, too, should make people concerned about the purchasing power of U.S. dollar-denominated investments. But more pernicious still, is negative real interest rates. Let's look at the arithmetic around the U.S. 10-year Treasury. The government purports to pay you, and they will, because they can print. What's the rate now? 2%? 1.7%? I don't know.
The 10-year?
Yeah.
About 2%.
2%. Okay. So let's do the arithmetic. They propose to pay you 2% in a currency that, depending on which government agency you ask, is declining in purchasing power by 6.5 or 7.5% a year. Let's use 6.5, the most conservative number, the best number for them. What is 2% minus 6.5%? It's minus 4.5%. The US government is guaranteeing that if you loan them money for 10 years, they will cost you 4.5% of your purchasing power a year, compounded for 10 years. This is the first promise they've made me in my life that I'm absolutely certain they'll keep. This is what Jim Grant calls return-free risk, or what Friedrich Hayek called a certificate of guaranteed confiscation. If there's anything that ought to make you concerned about the efficacy of your purchasing power in conventionally denominated savings and investment assets, an absolute guaranteed loss should be one. But it gets better, George. The market share of precious metals and precious metals related assets in the United States market today is about 0.5%, down from a three-decade mean of between 1.5% or 2%. So gold doesn't need to really, really seriously outcompete the dollar. It needs to lose a little less badly. If demand for precious metals and precious metals related assets as a consequence of quantitative easing, debt and deficits, and negative real interest rates were only to return to a three-decade mean, demand would triple or quadruple. Finally, there's one more. You got to let me do this because it's just compelling. After 40 years of benign economic climate, the biggest investors in the world, the big institutions, the endowments, the sovereign wealth funds, the pension funds, have followed an allocation scheme that's roughly 60% equity, 40% debt. And that's worked great for 40 years while the interest rates were falling. But you can't take the interest rates too far below zero. The consequence of that now is that the biggest investors in the world have a portfolio where 40% of their portfolio is guaranteed to lose the money, guaranteed to reduce their ability to meet pension obligations 20 years from now, guaranteed not to be able to help them fund the upkeep of universities like Stanford or Harvard, guaranteed to make future beneficiaries of a sovereign wealth fund, let's say citizens of nations like Norway, poorer, guaranteed to make them poorer. What that means is that those same portfolio managers need to begin to disintermediate out of bonds into asset classes that have better track records during periods of inflation. I don't know one better than gold. I'm not trying to say that Norges Bank, the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world, will sell their bond portfolio, 40%, $400 billion and put all in gold. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is that we're going to get at least a reversion to mean as a consequence of the fact that 40% of those assets are held in an asset class that guarantees them a loss. I feel pretty good about the gold price. On top of that, the gold stocks, measured by net present value, which I define as the net present value of future cash flows of defined and developed reserves and resources at current commodity prices, either the current spot price or looking forward at the strip price, the net present value of these companies relative to their enterprise value, relative to what you would pay to buy the take the company private, market capitalization plus debt, is the cheapest that it's been in my 45-year career. So we have a circumstance where the companies are discounting the commodity price, and I think the commodity price is going to go up. Now, is this going to happen in the near term? Maybe not. I mean, maybe the Fed can raise interest rates. Maybe the US dollar continues strong. But it's been very interesting to me to looking at the last 5 weeks where the Fed has jawboned the interest rate higher. They've succeeded in raising the nominal interest rate. The US dollar is very strong. And gold is strong at the same time the US dollar is strong.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen 3 or 4 times before in my career. And in every case, that was a springboard for gold. Remember the old saying that gold goes up on an elevator. It goes up immediately and sharply. It comes down on an escalator. And people have been waiting a long time for gold to do something. But in my lifetime, seeing periods where gold did well in a period of rising interest rates and strengthening US dollar has been very rare and very rewarding.
Do you think a potential war with Russia plays into the price of gold?
In my experience, geopolitical events have been excuses to take the gold higher in the near term. But the fundamental is the expectation or lack of expectation, or put differently, faith in purchasing power participation in dollar-denominated investment and savings products.
Okay.
If fear of Russian conflict subsided, could it impact the gold price in the near term? Sure.
If it escalates, could it, you know,
yeah, the price? In the near term, I mean, from a trader's point of view, but from a fundamental point of view, from an investor's point of view, the gold price is all about the maintenance of purchasing power in savings and investment assets of other sorts.
Yeah. Rick, I know I've kept you too long, my friend, so we'll go ahead and leave it there. And I just want to circle back and discuss the boot camp. But for the viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go? And then tell them about the bank, too. I forgot about the bank.
Yeah. Let's start with the bank, because that's what I'm having the most fun with right now. In retirement, I've decided to start a bank,
yeah.
Kind of thing that old retired guys do. for a couple of reasons. I backed the same team. In 1998, they started a bank called EverBank, one of the first online banks in the country. For early investors, it was a 30X, meaning they got 30 time returns, which even at age 69 is not unattractive to me. But importantly, over 15 years, the bank grew from 0 to $28 billion, I think, in AUM. We took it public on the New York Stock Exchange, ultimately sold it to TIAA CREF. TIAA CREF didn't need all the things that made the bank great. They needed the platform, they needed the mortgage business because they have 1.5 million members. So from TIAA's point of view, all the things that made the bank unique were redundant. And they've discontinued most of those business lines.
Wow.
The old customers of EverBank have been saying for a long time, what happened to our bank? Where's our bank? And so we're gonna restart it. It's gonna be an old fashioned bank. The comptroller of the currency suggests that 7% equity to total assets is well capitalized. I'm an old man. I believe 10 or 11 is well capitalized. The banking industry today believes that they should lend a 5 to 7 year term on fixed rates and fund that with overnight funds on variable rates, meaning that if you have a liquidity squeeze like 2008 where short-term rates go up, these guys could be out of business. Big banks today think that they can have nominal derivatives exposure on their balance sheet at $200 or $300 trillion. I'm not smart enough to have derivatives that are 300 or 400 times my shareholders' equity. So I want to have a bank that doesn't have derivatives. I want to lend against physical gold and physical silver. I want to lend against real assets. I want deposits from real people. So this is an old fashioned bank, one that will pay because it can afford to deposit interest rates that are in the top decile of deposit interest rates countrywide, banks that won't grow for the sake of growing or leverage, but will rather loan against good liquid collateral to good, well-collateralized people. So anybody who cares about this bank, either in terms of borrowing from us, particularly against their physical gold or silver holdings, or depositing in a bank where primary collateral is gold and silver, should get in touch with me. I'm going to make it easy for your listeners, as I always have. People who enjoy my thoughts on natural resources can get them in a much less general, much more specific fashion by going to a website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. Okay. There, you can enter your natural resource stocks on the web form. Please no crypto, please no tech stocks, please no pot stocks, not even any tobacco stocks. And I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I'll comment on individual issues if I think my comments have any value. And then down in the question line, if you care about my bank, say bank. Okay. If you care too, if you're an accredited investor, about the private placements I'm participating in, you know, I didn't used to be able to tell people about that, George, because it was regarded as a solicitation. Right. But I'm retired. I'm not soliciting anything now. So I have a free service where I describe every private placement I enter into for accredited investors. I mean, they can get into them.
Right.
But it's free. If you care about my placements, in the question line, say placements. So bank placements. If you care about the boot camp, as I understand it, George, you'll have a link to that boot camp, and I hope I see you there, George.
I'd love to do it. If my schedule's open, which I think it will be, I'll be there for sure.
Well, in your particular case, I'll comp you, and you, if you can't make it the 19th, make it the 21st or the 27th or whatever it is, because the information isn't going to go stale in the near term. It's going to be a wonderful thing. Anyway, your subscribers can look at the link, hit the link, and as I say, complete, no questions asked, money back guarantee if people attend the conference. You can't sign up, not go, and say, give me my money back. But if you attend it, if you put in an honest effort, you think it wasn't worth your while or it isn't something that's going to benefit you, money back, no questions asked.
Going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. All right, Rick, man, as always, incredible conversation. I just can't thank you enough for your time and the content you've put out. I think I've told you this many times, but when I first got into this world in 2012, when I retired, you and Doug and Jim Rogers and Jim Grant were definitely some of the people that I learned the most from. So I told Jim this when I was on a panel, Jim Grant, when I was on a panel discussion with him at the New Orleans Investment Conference, that if it wasn't for him, I don't think I'd be where I am today. And that goes for you as well. If it wasn't for you and everything I learned from you, I probably wouldn't have the experience or the knowledge that I do have that enables me to produce the content I produce. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to teach. I look forward to participating in your sessions live somewhere in the future. I hear great things about the gatherings that you put together, and I look forward to attending them. And I look forward to sharing spiritus beverage with you in the evening.
All right, sounds good. On that note, Rick, enjoy the rest of your afternoon, my friend.
Thanks, George. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.